From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with award-winning director and playwright Lisa Peterson, who has penned a translation to Hamlet for the Play on Shakespeare project, which is a series published by ACMRS Press. Lisa Peterson is a two-time Obie Award-winning director and writer. She created and co-wrote An Iliad with Dennis O'Hare, based on Homer's epic poem. She also recently directed their second collaboration, The Good Book, at Berklee Repertory. In addition to many classic plays, Lisa has directed new works across the country. The Play on Shakespeare project aims to tease out what we mean by contemporary modern English. These aren't translations in the traditional sense. They look at Shakespeare's plays through the lens of the English we speak today. How much has the English language changed since Shakespeare? Is it possible that there are conventions in the early modern English of Shakespeare that don't translate to us today, especially in the moment of hearing it spoken out loud, as one does in the theater? My interview with Lisa Peterson begins with the two of us reading different versions of a passage from Hamlet. It's the somewhat famous passage where Hamlet is speaking with Horatio and a gravedigger about a skull that has just been unearthed from the graveyard. It's the skull of the old court jester, Yorick. So I speak first, reading from the original passage, and then Lisa follows with her contemporized translation, after which you will hear us discuss the new book. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. He hath borne me on his back 1,000 times, and now how abhorred in my imagination it is, my gorge rims at it. Here hung those lips that I have kissed I know not how oft. Where be your gibes now, your gambols, your songs, your flashes of merriment, that were wont to set the table on a roar? Not one now to mock your own grinning, quite chapfallen. Now get you to my lady's chamber and tell her. Let her paint an inch thick. To this favor she must come. Make her laugh at that. Prithee, Horatio, tell me one thing. What's that, my lord? Dost thou think Alexander looked o' this fashion i' the earth? E'en so. And smelt so? Pah! So that's the original, that's me reading from the original version of Hamlet, doing the best I could. And now here's Lisa Peterson reading her translation of that same passage.
Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent imagination. He bore me on his back 1,000 times, and now how abhorrent it is to think about. My gorge rises at it. Here hung those lips that I have kissed, I know not how often. Where be your tricks now, your dances, your songs, your flashes of merriment that used to make the table roar with laughter? Not a single joke now to mock your own grinning, quite down in the mouth. Now get you to my lady's chamber and tell her, even if she paints her face an inch thick, she'll look this way in the end. Make her laugh at that. Please, Horatio, tell me one thing. What's that, my lord? Do you think Alexander looked like this in the earth? Just like that. And smelled like this? Phew!
Thank you.
Sure.
So I thought that was kind of a good selection to try, because a lot of people are familiar, at least with the scene where they are regarding the skull. And that is the scene where they are regarding the skull of poor Yorick, the king's jester. So I'm just wondering if we can now talk a little bit about how you came to be the person to translate Hamlet for this project.
I know. It's a kind of a ridiculous assignment in a way. And I came to it in a sort of roundabout way because I am primarily a director.
Okay.
And in the last 15 years, I had returned to my early love of adaptation. So I had been writing, and I guess I would call myself now a writer-director. I've been writing. I did an adaptation of an Iliad with an actor named Dennis O'Hare. We made it together, and we're now working on our third play. So I really do write, but I'm still very loath to call myself a writer because I work with writers a lot. I'm I direct classics, but I also direct new plays, and I have a great reverence for the art of writing. Anyway, I was directing Hamlet at Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and I was having a meeting with Louis Dothet, whose brainchild this really is, this whole thing. And I saw a dry erase board in her office, a huge one, that had every single Shakespeare play. And then next to it was the name of a contemporary American writer who was going to do the translation. And I noticed that no one was translating Hamlet. It was blank. And I don't know. I was sitting there and I said, half jokingly, well, you should let me do it. I'll do it. And then we kind of looked at each other and laughed. And she said, well, are you serious? I said, I don't know. I mean, I'm working on the play now. I felt like it would be easy for me to do.
Right.
And in some way, I felt like I would step in where maybe no one else wanted to step in because I felt that I didn't have a writer's reputation to defend. And at the time it seemed radical, this idea. And I thought, oh, no one, you know, it's okay. I don't have anything to lose to take on Hamlet. So that's how it happened. She said, if you're serious, let's talk about it. And kept talking about it. And of course I didn't have a lot of spare time while I was directing Hamlet there. So in the end, I ended up starting the translation well after I had finished directing the production. But by then I had spent a lot of time with the play. So it was a joy, I will say. It was a surprise to me how enjoyable it was mm-hmm. to work on the play in this way. And it definitely was a playwriting class to get in deep line by line, idea by idea. I had done some version of that to direct it, but this was even more microscopic.
Right, right. And I should mention that the section we read really is kind of like a line by line translation job. Like you basically were looking at those lines and making changes, very subtle changes, I think, to make it a little bit more digestible for a contemporary audience. But some of the sections are more, you know, you kind of look at a whole section and figure out a way to make us understand the whole section by maybe summarizing it a little bit, you know, combining a couple of different lines and taking out an interspersed line from another character just to make it more understandable.
That's right. Well, originally the assignment, as Louis passed it on, was pretty specific, which was, well, the headline was first, do no harm.
I loved that. Yeah.
And the next assignment was that she hoped that we would maintain all of the grammatical structures. That's not the right way to put it, but this was not meant to be a free adaptation. This was meant to be a translation, meaning we were, if the passage was in, it was in verse, it needed to stay in verse. If it rhymed, it really should still rhyme. If it was prose, which is what we just read was prose, mm-hmm. It needed to be in prose. And at first, it was actually meant that it was meant to be line by line. I mean, if this was a 12-line passage, it needed to remain a 12-line passage. So the assignment was fairly surgical, I thought. You know, as time went on, and I saw a couple of other people's translations as models, and also I struggled with clarity. And I talked to Louis and said, can I cut this passage? Can I condense this? Because I'm having a hard time staying at 24 lines, you know, especially in the sections that I would say are describing historical events. Like the Horatio's speech in the first scene, in which he tries to encapsulate what has just happened in the kingdom,
right,
in terms of the old King Hamlet, the new King the new young Hamlet, and Fortinbras and Fortinbras's father. Like, the backstory is a section that was almost impossible to make clear on stage, I found. And so I think that some of the more radical things I did ended up being in those kind of backstory passages, the exposition.
Right.
And this speech of, and the other thing is Hamlet, because there are so many famous passages. I felt that my job was not to replace something famous with something else, because I think the job of these translations is to allow an audience to listen and not quite know why they get it, mm-hmm. but to still think they're hearing Shakespeare. They're not here to hear a play by me. This is not a play by me. My job is just to clear the wax out a little bit, gently enough that you still know you're seeing this play, but you can actually understand it. And honestly, this is what a director does in a production. Often I would sort of replace words, invert, move around.
I liked in the introduction you write, every director does a certain amount of adapting a Shakespeare text for their particular production. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting, because I'm not a director. I didn't know that Shakespeare could be tweaked.
Oh, yes. So. And sometimes more than tweaked.
Yeah.
But, you know, and the hardest parts of Shakespeare to communicate now are the clown sections, like the comedic sections, because they were topical.
Right. I was wondering, there's a little clown section that precedes what we just read about Yorick that you cut. And I was like, is she protecting Ophelia? Was that because they were very dismissive of Ophelia in that section where she's about to be buried in this scene.
Yeah.
And that's why we're in the graveyard in the first place. And I was sort of like, yay, you you got rid of these. But I wasn't sure if it was about.
Well, the other thing one has to remember about Hamlet is, there is great difference between the folio and the couple of quartos.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's actually possible. And I can't say for sure, because I haven't had my head in this for at least a year now.
Yeah.
But it's possible that a passage like that actually isn't in the folio or isn't in the second quarto. So anytime you do Hamlet, you actually have to pick and you have to decide, you know, which version you're going to use. You can use some of each, but there is not a definitive
single text.
Hamlet.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's good to know.
But I don't remember why I didn't. I definitely was not protecting Ophelia.
Okay.
I either thought this is untranslatable, although I doubt that. I may have not been. That might be something that's in a quarto and not in the folio or something
okay.
like that.
Okay. And I don't know what I was. I just found what I thought was the original on the internet. So,
oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
So good luck with that. let's see. What would your preference be for how this translation is used and by whom? It struck me that this could be read by readers who just simply want a more understandable version of Hamlet. It could also be taught by teachers who want their students to study the text and see, you know, sort of what the different words. I found it fascinating what some of the words meant that I hadn't really ever heard of before. So what would your preference be, or what are you thinking?
Well, I don't know. That's interesting. I hadn't thought of either of those options. I hadn't thought about just readers, and I hadn't thought about classrooms. I was assuming that hopefully a director or two
will produce
or a producer or two would decide, you know, this is a skillful adaptation. I really do think my adaptation is fairly not exactly invisible, but it doesn't hit you over the head. It's fairly surgical. So I guess I thought, maybe a couple of people will decide to do this version. That may not happen, because like I say, directors generally do this. And so I don't know if another director would say, I'm going to do Lisa's adaptation of this. But then again, I've done all the work for them for clarity. So I was definitely thinking about a production, somebody else's production in front of an audience.
Okay.
But I like your idea. I think that's right, that certainly studying them side by side is a way to start to understand even more deeply how Shakespeare structured things.
Yeah, yeah, that's totally struck me that that would be a great way to use it, maybe in middle school. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, we studied Shakespeare. It was pretty early, but in my school, our fourth grade teacher every year would teach us a Shakespeare play, and then we would put it on. And I know that's crazy for fourth graders, but I certainly think by middle school and early high school, they are studying Shakespeare, and this would be a great way for them to read it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Let's see. Did you, I know that you mentioned looking at some of the other authors' translations. Did you collaborate with anybody or get together and talk about what people were doing, or did you just sort of happen to see things and decide to talk to Louis?
I didn't really get together with anybody. I think Ellen McLaughlin is a good friend of mine, and we had a couple of conversations because she got hers done quite early.
And which one did she do?
Oh, dear. I think she did Pericles.
Okay.
And she's a poet. Ellen is a great writer. So I did have a couple of early conversations with her. And then, of course, I worked very deeply with my dramaturg on this, Luann Schooler, who actually had drama when I had done the first time I ever directed a Shakespeare play. It was Antony and Cleopatra, and I directed it at Berkeley Rep. Luann had been my dramaturg at that time. Mm-hmm. And so she and I worked very closely on this. And she's the one who I would just go line by line with her and say, I know, you know, the Arden note on that word or this idea says this, but I still don't understand it. What do you think? Often she would recommend words that might work or phrases that might work. So we were really a team.
So when you said the Arden note, you just picked up a book and showed it to me, but we can't see that on the radio. Talk about what the Arden note is. What is that?
Oh, well, the Arden is a favorite. I really love the Arden editions when I'm directing of the notes in them. So, you know, if you're reading Arden, you would go, oh, let's see. In the original of what we just read, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. And then you look down and you see fancy. Arden says it means invention. So I would always have to say, well, how is what I'm doing any different from just, you know, putting notes in a version? But I don't think I used the word invention.
I think you used imagination.
Yes, right. So I could have used invention. I didn't want to always be copying the Arden notes. It wasn't only Arden. I think we were looking at probably three or four different editions of notes.
Sure.
And that's just to kind of glean what is the meaning. And then I would think, well, what is he really, if it's now, what do we mean by invention?
Right.
Now? I mean, does invention mean now what it meant then? So I chose imagination because he's talking to a jester, as you said, but somebody who made him laugh, somebody who was a performer.
And it sounds like somebody who was kind to him and
somebody who was kind
and loved
to him. That's right.
Which not a lot of people do.
Yeah.
Now, Hamlet considers avenging his father's murder his own responsibility. In just talking about the play, do you think that that's because of his mother's involvement, or do you think that's simply because a son should avenge his father's murder? What is your take on that?
I guess at first, I think there's emotion involved before there's an intellectual idea about who should or shouldn't. I think he is furious.
Yeah.
And bereft. But he's furious because he knows that now that because the wedding is about to happen and the funeral just happened, he feels duped. He feels discarded. And he knows that his father has just died. He, I think, is very ambivalent about taking the crown himself. I don't think he really wants to be the king of Denmark, but he knows he should.
Okay.
I mean, he knows the way it looks from outside is he's supposed to be the, if his father dies, he should be the king, not his uncle.
Right.
So all of it is infuriating to him.
All right, great. Let's see. So I did notice there were some language things that surprised me. So, you know, he's always telling people to get places, get thee to a nunnery, get to my mother's, you know, room. I forget what the line was that we just read. But the thing that surprised me was in some cases he says, get thee. And then he also says, get you. And then sometimes you, I think actually all the time you translated thee as you. I think that was one of your sort of regular, you know, translations. But why, or do you know enough about the language of the time? Well, why was there you and thee? And when did they use the differences? Do you know?
I know generally.
Okay.
And I will say, first of all, I can't remember if it was my own impulse, or I think it may have been in conversation with Louis about what we were doing and why.
Right.
One thing I was doing was scrubbing the text for almost any language that was particularly Elizabethan. So that the idea would be, this play would now sound as if it was happening now. And you wouldn't miss all the these and thous. But I was really, in fact, I would take a pass and Louis would come back at me and say, you missed this thou or this thinkest thou. So do you think would be the more, so I was always getting rid of any Elizabethan turn of phrase or trying my best. Sometimes I look at it now and I see, oh, I should have reversed the word order in that sentence, because that's another thing that Shakespeare often does, is he puts like this, the object before the subject, or,
right.
you know.
Which is so interesting, because it's like French or Spanish in that way. And it's interesting to see that tie to how they used to speak.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think part of it probably was that he was doing that to fit the meter, and he could do it.
Okay.
But I'm not sure it was always that. I also think that must have been a common locution, that exactly like you said, like in French or Spanish, you could put the verb in a different place. And we don't do that in English anymore. But my understanding of you and thee, and I am not a specialist in this, but is that it is actually very much like the French vous or tu.
Oh,
so that
it's a formality thing.
The formality thing.
Ah.
Yes. So my understanding is that the has more formality and you is more direct. I may in fact have that backwards, but anyway,
it certainly sounds like the would be formal.
I removed it because, as we know in English now, we don't have that distinction anymore.
Right.
We use you across the board. So I was trying my best to take out those Elizabethan mannerisms.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, the very first line of the play is, who's there? And you didn't have to do anything to that. And I thought, that's so contemporary. Who's there? And I was reading it and I was like, wasn't it who goes there? And then I like started searching and it's not who goes there ever. I don't know where that comes from.
I know. That's the amazing thing about Hamlet, really. And I think I say this in the introduction. Unlike, you name it, Two Gentlemen of Verona, so many other Shakespeare plays, Hamlet doesn't need very much translation. To be or not to be, that is the question. That's completely accessible to us. And so many other things too. So really there were not very many. There were tiny Elizabethanisms that went away. And then the hardest parts, as I've already said, the things that I found the places needed the most translation were the expositional passages. A lot of Claudius's language, especially if it was in court and political, was very hard to not just understand, but figure out how to give it the right heft and intrigue. So those were the things that were the really, really heavy lifts. And actually, not so much Alas, Poor Yorick, but overall, the gravedigger scene. As it happened, I had done what I've considered a pretty radical translation of that for the production.
I was just going to ask you, because you had just done a production that looked pretty cool. And the gravedigger was a musician named Scott Kelly.
Yes.
Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted you because I wanted to look smart. But
No. Well, that's exactly right. I decided that I wanted him to preside over the whole production. And he's a heavy, he has a, it's called doom metal band that's really popular in the, across the country. It's called Neurosis. And so he is a performer. He's really intense performer, but he's not an actor. And so in order to have him do it, I knew that I needed it to make sense. I couldn't have him speaking dialogue that was arcane.
Sure.
I mean, here, like, here's a line. Hamlet first meets the gravedigger and says, "How long have you been gravemaker?" "I started on the day that our last King Hamlet defeated old Fortinbras." "How long ago was that?" "Don't you know that? Every fool knows that. It was that very day that young Hamlet was born." I mean, so that's a lot more direct than and understandable than the original. But I mean, now that I'm looking at it, I don't know really that it's that. Oh, here's one. Yes. Now here's a skull that has lain in the earth 23 years. Whose was it? A poor mad fellow's. Whose do you think it was? I don't know. This same skull, sir, was Yorick's skull, the king's jester. So.
I don't know.
Yeah. I did that translation because I had Scott Kelly playing. And the gravedigger is meant to be not a fancy talker. I mean, he is the clown part in Hamlet, but he is meant to be a working class, witty, but not fancy person. So it made sense to me. And so for me, the translation kind of grew out of the gravedigger scene.
Yeah. And so do you feel like having just put on that production, this was the perfect time to have taken on this project, even though I think you originally thought you could kind of do it simultaneously, and then you realized later, I'm going to have to just focus on the play and then do the translation.
Right.
But
yeah, it did work out well. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't have taken it on. I wouldn't have volunteered myself if I hadn't known that I was going to be inside it. If I had to start it now, I don't know that I could. But because I had been inside it, it was perfectly timed, and it was kind of a once in a lifetime opportunity to spend another couple of years inside the play after I'd already been physically inside it, so that I had, you know, I kind of knew what I thought it felt like to be in there. It is a great play.
It's the best.
It is play. A really great play.
When I heard about the series, I said, well, are you doing Hamlet? Because that's definitely the one I'd want to reread. Let's see. So now you said that you write, but you don't consider yourself a writer. Do you write plays? Is that what you mostly take on? And have you produced any of your own plays?
Yes. Back when I was starting as a director, so, you know, 30 years ago, one of the first things that I did that got me any attention was an adaptation of Virginia Woolf's The Waves. And it was actually, I collaborated with a composer friend of mine named David Bucknam. And we were both very, very, very young. First, I adapted it without music. He was in it. And then he decided, I'm going to turn it into a musical. And when I say musical, it's somewhere in the world between a musical, a cantata, and an opera. You know, it's kind of a music theater piece, but it has some aspects of a musical to it. So he and I actually did that in Ithaca at the Hangar Theater, which is where we had met. And Jim Nicola from New York Theater Workshop came up to see it. And we did it at New York Theater Workshop in 1989. And it started my career. It got very good reviews and people came to see it. And it was my break in a way. So,
but it was your break into directing and not necessarily writing. Is that
not
correct?
That's right. And it was my break into directing, not necessarily writing. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. So then I began to direct, and I sort of left writing behind. And I'm not exact. Well, I will say that my friend David and I, we did a couple of other things, but we kept finding it hard to make something else work the way that the Waves had worked. And my friend David died very young. And so I just kind of put that whole part of myself in a box and became a director. About 15 years ago, because I had a very strong impulse to get back into it. So in part because I really wanted to, I had a particular idea, which was, it was, you know, it was 2003. We were now a country at war, but in Iraq. And I thought, we need to know, we need to be thinking about this. And that led me to an idea about adapting Homer's Iliad as a solo, that in order to kind of recreate for people the experience of hearing someone like Homer, you know, tell the story of the Trojan War. So Dennis and I started working on that as an adaptation. It is an adaptation, but as time went on and we worked on it more and more, we began really writing it. So that adaptation of an Iliad happened also at New York Theater Workshop in 2012. It won awards, it won an Obie, it won a Lortel.
Right, right.
And that was the moment where I decided, well, I do enjoy writing and I can do it. And so Dennis and I wrote another play called The Good Book, which is about faith and the Christian Bible. And it is really not an adaptation, although it looks at a book. And in some places, it's adapting certain parts of the Christian Bible. It's really an original play. We created all the characters. It's original. And now we're working on a third piece, which is really about empire and government. And we're using the story of Rome. It's called The Song of Rome, but it's highly original. It's all original. And I'm also working with Todd Almond on a musical piece that is inspired by Wallace Stevens' life and poetry, but very loosely.
Wow.
Yeah. So I have now, I would say I spend at least a third of my time, if not half of it, thinking about and working on writing projects, and half of it directing. And I find that I think it's what I always wanted to do. I mean, the thing about directing is you're an interpretive artist, and the primary artist, of course, is the writer, and your job is to bring it to life.
But it sounds like your writing is always in service to your work as a director.
That's interesting. In some ways it is, because I kind of imagine something and then I write it to bring it so that I can direct it. Although lately I've become really excited about the idea of other people directing an Iliad. For instance, an Iliad has been produced all over the country in many theaters, large and small, and quite a few really amazing directors have taken it on and interpreted it in different ways, cast it in different ways. So I am starting to love that idea too, you know.
Have you gone to those productions?
In some cases I've watched them on, I've seen a filming of the production. I haven't been able to actually go to too many, I will say that, but I love hearing about them.
Great. Okay. Lisa, I like to ask my guests what they've read lately that they've enjoyed and might recommend to listeners. And it doesn't have to be a play. It can be fiction, nonfiction, poetry, whatever, or play. Anything come to mind?
Sure. Well, I only in this past year finally read The Overstory, Richard Powers' Pulitzer-winning novel.
People love that. I have not read that.
It's about trees. It's so good. And I just was reading yesterday that he has come out with not exactly a sequel, but a related book that I can't wait to read. That's gorgeous. I will say that I really got into reading James Baldwin this past year. So like Go Tell It on the Mountain, Giovanni's Room. I've loved reading those. I had seen a stage adaptation, but I had never actually read Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. Mm-hmm. So I read The Bluest Eye a couple months ago, which is killer. I mean, it's just incredible. And it's so abstract.
Yeah, she's wonderful. Oh, just so amazing. Yeah.
And then I will say that I also just started reading a memoir that actually a former neighbor, a friend of mine, Dan Koppel, wrote with his, I think his uncle, who's a emergency room doctor. The book is called Every Minute is a Day.
Okay.
And it's quite intense memoir of 2020 from the point of view of an emergency room doctor in the Bronx dealing with COVID. And I know it sounds like too hard to touch, but for me, for some reason, being reminded of that kind of what March and April were like in New York, in the Bronx, I actually find it very moving and soothing because I think we're in a moment where we don't know how to feel about all of what has happened yet. And just to have it marked and remembered, it did happen. And this is what it felt like from that point of view.
Well, I would think as a New Yorker, I mean, I feel like New Yorkers, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like New Yorkers went through 9/11 sort of together in a way, whereas they went through the pandemic very much in solitude, a lot of people, right? Yeah. Because there was the lockdown and you were with whom you could be.
That's right.
Yeah. I just have one last question before we finish up. And I always like to ask for advice at the end for writers. In your prologue, you begin, I must have lost my mind because you had taken on this project to translate Hamlet. Now that you have finished, do you have any advice for listeners who are writers about taking on a project that they find perhaps intimidating?
As I've been saying, the idea that I would give advice to writers is... I'm loath to even go there, but let me think about this. Because, like I said, for so many years, I've worked with amazing writers, and I find the act of writing still mysterious and magical. But I guess I would say, I mean, so I'm going to offer this mostly from observation,
okay,
even more than from practice. But I think that the best writing does come from things that are frightening to the writer. And I know that the more it feels impossible, the more necessary it is. And you don't know until you get it out. You just got to put it down and get it out there. I do think that the big trick, of course, is to shut up the chattering ego on your shoulder and just get that part of yourself to be quiet and go into another room so that you can lay down, get out from inside your brain what is there, and then let some time pass and then take a look at it. The big trick is don't judge while you do it.
Perfect. That's great advice.
Okay.
I've been speaking with Lisa Peterson, who is the author-translator of Hamlet, Play on Shakespeare, published by ACMRS Press, which is the Arizona Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies out of Arizona State University. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Lisa Peterson. The excerpt that she read was from Hamlet, Play on Shakespeare, copyright 2021, published by the Arizona Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies. This week's Write the Book prompt is to choose a piece of your work and try to translate it for a different audience than it was originally intended. Change the language so that it might have made sense 300 years ago, or put it into words you could read to a child. Change it to appeal to someone from a different culture. If you are bilingual, maybe translate it into another language. Think about how the words create the work and how changing the words changes the work. It sounds really obvious, but of course, the way that we put words together on the page is so important as far as getting our point across, our story across, our poems across, and the way that that it will be received changes for different audiences. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so do be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any prompts that you might have missed. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book. The podcast site is writethebook.podbean.com, and we are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, lots of other sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, as I say every week, please rate it where you find it and like it on social media and spread the word. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.